This episode of the Vision Board Podcast is brought to you by Onnit. Why Onnit, you ask? Well, here's a word from Onnit's founder and CEO, Aubrey Marcus.
You know, Onnit is the company that has the tools to improve your performance. And in whatever area that you're looking for, we have something to do it. You know, it's like going to it's the Home Depot of house repair, but instead of house repair, it's body and mind repair. You know, and it's body and mind performance enhancement. It's going to that body shop and figuring out what tools that you can apply to help make your life better.
At the Vision Board Podcast, we only promote supplements that we use ourselves, and we only use the best. To give you insights, here's Johnny.
Yeah, guys, my two favorite that I take, one, Alpha Brain. Alpha Brain really helps improve mental focus and memory, and the second one I really swear by is Shroom Tech. Shroom Tech is designed to help your body with energy and cardiovascular endurance. What's your favorite, Tristan?
Johnny, the two that I love is the Warrior Buffalo Bars. I find these delicious snacks, and they're also perfect for when I'm on the road and also on the run. Also, I love the Dolce Whey. They're grass-fed whey protein isolate, perfect for my smoothies and also my post-workout shakes. Now, guys, check out the range at www.onnit.com, and please use code word VISIONBOARD for 10% off at checkout. Now, guys, enjoy the show.
Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And now, listen in as Tristan and Johnny bring it all to the table on the Vision Board Podcast.
Guys, welcome back. Episode 123 of the Vision Board Podcast. I'm Tristan Cannell, and alongside me, Johnny Stofko.
What's up, Tristan? I love the sequential pattern of 1, 2, 3.
I love those numbers, man.
Yeah, perfect. The only time that'll happen.
Yeah.
You know, we can't reverse time. Who we got today?
We got a big one, man. We got Brian Habana. Brian is a South African rugby union player. One of my favorite players, actually. His need for speed, that's what I call him, because he's just super fast.
Yeah, it's his speed when people bring up his name. And then also, for me, other than his talent and his abilities, is that smile.
Yeah.
That frequency he floats on with that happiness just exuding through him. So having him sit down, stop by the vision board, I know you and I are both excited, and you guys listening will be as well.
Yeah, he's a very, very spiritual person, does a lot for the community. He's currently living in France, actually. He's playing in Toulon. So he's got the world record he's got the most tries in a Rugby World Cup. He's tied that with the great late Jonah Lomu, and that's over a World Cup and also in all World Cups put together. So the guy's got some stunning achievements. Also a world champion with the 2007 Springboks.
Springboks.
As well.
Yeah, he's 31 now, going into the latter ages of his career, and it's going to be awesome to get the insight on the mindset, the innovation, or the evolution of Brian Habana, because he came on as a younger guy, and he's been at that elite level for so long, so it's going to be awesome to sit down with him and talk about that process.
Yeah, he'll give us insights into growing up, because obviously South Africa is a lot different to where me and you grew up in America and Australia, so he'll give us a few insights into that, and it'll be interesting to see just the different, you know, views that he's got on that, and, you know, living away now in France as well.
Yeah, exactly, and, you know, we all have our timeline of our life, whatever country we grew up on, and one of the big ones for him, he's going to sit down with us a little bit about, you know, Nelson Mandela, the impact he's had on his people, mm-hmm. and living through that as a young boy and what it means to him. So, like we said, it's not just about the sport. It's more about, you know, the path.
Yeah.
And having a guy like Brian on the show, you know, can't say it enough. We're super excited.
Yeah, definitely. Big shout out to you guys, all you people, boys and girls listening to the show. We really appreciate all the messages of support. You know, the subscriptions, the 5-star reviews, everything. We really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, I can't say it enough, man. The ones who've been here since day one, the ones who just jumped on board, wherever you join us in this journey, we appreciate you the same. Continue with the feedback and support. Get involved with us. Support the journey. The Vision Board Podcast, man. We're doing it.
Yeah, share it with your family and friends. And remember, you can subscribe via iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and we might even start doing a few more shows via the video on YouTube, so stay tuned for that.
Yeah, they've been asking for you on video, Tristan, man. You got to give it to them.
We'll see what we can do.
Yes, sir.
All right, guys. In the meantime, here's Brian Habana. All right, our special guest is Brian Habana. Brian is a South African rugby union player who plays on the wing for French club Toulon. He has 124 caps for South Africa, and in 2007, not only was he part of the World Cup winning team, but he equaled the late Jonah Lomu's record for most tries in a single World Cup, and was also named the IRB Player of the Year. We welcome Brian Habana. Brian, welcome to the show, my man.
Evening, gentlemen. Lovely to be on the show. Thanks for having me. Thanks for squeezing me in the time difference. Friday night here in Toulon, but all good. Great to be on board.
Brian, we appreciate you stopping by the Vision Board. Could you share with our fans and your fans alike currently what you're getting prepared for right now and what the season's turning out to be for Brian Habana?
Yeah, Johnny, so we're sort of into the second half of the Northern Hemisphere season with Toulon at the moment. 2016, a pretty disappointing year from a Springbok point of view, which saw us probably get our worst success win record, I think, in the history. It's also seen us drop to number 8th in the world. So, you know, pretty tough year for new coach Alistair Coetzee, and, you know, for a lot of us that, you know, wanted to make a difference, didn't quite go that way. You know, things with Toulon not really going that much better. We had a new coach at the start of the season after Bernard Laporte's tenure, Diego Dominguez, who after 2.5 months got sacked, and then, you know, Mike Ford took over. Then we had Steve Meehan leave, and, you know, Richard Cockrell come in. So it's been a bit of an inconsistent season from a Toulon point of view as well. You know, we haven't been playing well away from home either, which has made my consistency very difficult. Got a good record win against Bayonne at home in Stade Mayol last week, and you know, on the road this weekend to Grenoble, who are also in a bit of turmoil. There's quite a bit of news coming out of the French rugby circles, you know, with the whole Racing Metro Stade-Francais merger that came out this week. You know, coaches getting sacked left, right and centre at the moment. So, interesting times up in France. I think England are sort of ruining the nest in terms of the Six Nations, and, you know, they're going for a record, you know, consecutive win against the Irish this weekend. So, you know, French rugby in a bit of turmoil, but, you know, hopefully from a Toulon point of view, we can pick things up on this weekend and heading into the, you know, this for the finishing straight of the season, you know, do pretty well after losing a top 14 final last year. So a lot of pressure on us, given the amount of, you know, players and caliber of players we have. But looking forward to the end of the season.
Brian, before we get into your individual strengths and career, could you share with us a little bit about the culture of winning in the Springboks locker room, and as the years go, the importance of keeping that a tradition?
Yeah, John, so obviously, I think, you know, going up to 2007, you know, under Jake White, you know, South Africa were, I want to say, in a similar position as we are now, but we'd just come off a very disastrous Rugby World Cup 2003. You know, Jake White came in and, you know, started putting certain structures and elements into place into building towards a successful 2007 World Cup campaign in 2004. You know, he brought back the likes of a Percy Montgomery, a Osturant, a Brayton Paulser, who were sort of then the seniors with just over 50 test caps, and, you know, put together a group of youngsters that he believed that he could work together over a four-year period to, you know, not only sustain a level of play that was successful, but create a change of environment, you know, where success was truly important for us. It didn't quite go, you know, the sunshine and roses for the full four-year journey. You know, in 2006, we lost 49-0 to Australia in Brisbane, and, you know, a year out from a World Cup, you know, everyone was thinking that's not quite, you know, what it should be like. And I think the belief that Jake had in that squad, you know, that at that present moment in time, believing that no matter what obstacles we face, you know, we could go on and still become competitive and probably win the World Cup in 2007, you know, made guys like our captain John Smith and our core seniors, you know, guys like Victor Matfield, Farida Pereira, Skalk Berger, just that belief that kept constant within that group, and, you know, the youngsters that came in, you know, just fed off that as well. So, you know, leading up to 2007, you know, that was obviously really special to see what it had meant for South Africa post 95 and, you know, post how important that moment was for our country. But, you know, to do it outside of South Africa and see how important that was really special to be a part of. I think for me personally to have contributed to that was really fantastic. I think as a professional sportsman, you always want to be a part of a success story. But I think, you know, with South Africa and with its unique history and, you know, where it was and where it still is at the moment in terms of its democracy, in terms of having overcome the apartheid era and the elements that still exist within our country, I think you know, sport. And, you know, Nelson Mandela rightly said it at the opening of the Laureus Academy back in 2000, when he said that, you know, sport has this unique ability to bring people together and to inspire hope where there once was none. And I think for a lot of South Africans, that 95 group was that inspiration. And I think for me to have been inspired by that group and go on and then, you know, be a part of a group that inspired a new generation was pretty special. So I think success breeds success. And, you know, for us, you know, it was a combination of youth and experience, a combination of planning, meticulous planning, and knowing what our strengths and weaknesses are, acknowledging our weaknesses, you know, but not relying on our strengths to get us forward. So from a change of environment, I think it's really important that it's not just about the one person, it's not just about the one coach, it's about the totality of the environment, making sure that everyone's pulling in the same direction for the same goal. So, you know, that group went on to 2009, which again, you know, won in New Zealand for the second or third time in our history, won the Tri Nations, beat the British and Irish Lions, you know, went on to beat the All Blacks for three times in one year, which was really special. And to be able to have played with legends of the game, you know, like a John Smith, the Osterrand, Bucky Spurter, Victor Matfield, Skalk Berger, Frederick Breer, you know, the core of that 2007 side went on to become legends within rugby. So, you know, really fantastic to be a part of it. I think success is important in terms of you playing your part in contributing to the greater picture of the group.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to rugby, okay? Now, I'm going to go a little bit deep on you here, Brian. You mentioned that name, Nelson Mandela. I want to know, what does Nelson Mandela mean to you, man?
Yeah, Tristan, so for me, I grew up in the then apartheid South Africa, and even though I was born, you know, pre-South Africa's first democracy, I didn't really understand, you know, what the whole apartheid era was. I think as kids, we were very fortunate that our parents didn't bring us up hating. You know, so I had pink friends, blue friends, white, black, colored, Indian, and we never sort of got exposed to what the apartheid was. And I think for that, I'm really grateful to my parents. And I grew up playing soccer, you know, named after Brian Robson and Gary Bailey from Manchester United, sort of immediately inclined not only to support Manchester United, but want to play soccer. So, you know, grew up playing soccer, and then South Africa got the opportunity to host the 1995 Rugby World Cup. And again, there was a lot of, you know, post 94 when our first democratic elections happened and Nelson Mandela became president, a lot of reaction within South Africa in terms of where the country was heading. But to see how Nelson Mandela, after 27 years of having been in prison, having fought the system and come out on top, not have any hate in terms of, you know, trying to change everything immediately, understanding the importance that the Springboks played within where the country could go and the potential it has, was a I think for me, the biggest symbolizing factor was probably, you know, when he walked out onto Ellis Park, I think it was the 24th of June in 1995, with that number 6 Springbok rugby jersey on his back. And, you know, when he handed that cup to Francois Pienaar, and, you know, Francois said, this isn't for the 60,000 fans in the stadium, it's for the 43 million South Africans. I think that moment of unity, that moment of inspiration by, you know, two men from two totally different backgrounds who knew how important rugby was, who knew how important sport was, but that, you know, to go on and for Nelson to be that leader, you know, I think he'll probably go down as one of the most emphatic role players in, you know, in global history. And I think to be South African, to have been inspired by him, you know, was really fantastic. To have gone on and, you know, become a Springbok and have got the opportunity to meet him on quite a few occasions, you know, off the field as well, was really special. So to be able to sum up in words what a guy like that means in terms of inspiration, in terms of the way he led his, not only his struggle, but his, you know, his fight for freedom and giving back to the country is pretty difficult, because it is just so immense that, you know, I'm grateful. I was sitting there in Ellis Park on the 24th of June and, you know, was able to see that symbol of hope, to able to see that symbol of inspiration and see a man who defied all odds, you know, overcame all obstacles, and, you know, just knew that there was always potential in achieving greatness. And like I say, he was a phenomenal man, and really grateful that I got a lot of opportunities to meet him.
Brian, I used to live in Southern California, in Long Beach to be exact, and in 2000, I was there 2004 to about 2010, and right in the middle of the tourist area, there was a restaurant and bar called Springbok. And it was dedicated strictly to your team. What I want to know is, I know once a year the guys would come over, and it just, I always wondered, you being part of that, wearing, you know, being a Springbok, as a young boy, did you ever think you would be like have a global impact through sport?
John, I think, you know, as a young kid, you grow up watching your heroes. You grow up dreaming of doing the same one day. You grow up hoping you could do, but I don't think you'd fully realize it until you become it. If I have to be brutally honest, you know, I'll never forget, I was sort of driving on my way back from university back in 2004, and you know, I'd sort of just started coming into the professional rugby ranks, and you know, played a bit of under 21 rugby for the junior box, and you know, had a bit of sevens on the seven circuit in Wellington and Los Angeles. And my dad phoned me and he's like, listen, I think you've been selected into the Springbok group, you know, for the 2004 Tri Nations. And I was like, well, it's not the 1st of April. You know, this can't be happening. Are you joking? You know, almost roll your car. And then you sort of sit there and you try, take it all in and embrace the moment that, you know, that dream, that goal, that aspiration of what you wanted to achieve is now knocking on your doorstep. And then when you eventually get the opportunity to wear that green and gold jumper for the first time or your national jumper, it's like all this fulfillment of everything you've dreamed about, everything you've aspired to. But I think it's sort of only then, you know, where the real hard work starts happening, because once you make it, I think it's easy to just take it easy. But I think, you know, when I first became a Springbok, you know, my goal wasn't to just be there for one game or two games. You know, I didn't want to be a guy that was a flash in the pan, a one-year wonder. You know, I wanted to go on and, you know, get 50 caps for my test country, 100 test caps, and, you know, become a guy that, you know, once he eventually hangs up his boots, can look back at his career and be proud of what he's achieved. So, you know, I'm still going strong at the moment, 13 years later, and it's been a massive, massive privilege. I think, you know, I believe I've been blessed with the talent and gift to be able to do something I love each and every day of my life, and to be able to go out there and inspire kids, you know, and people throughout the world globally is a massive privilege, honor, and something I think once you've done, you really, really appreciate. But for the moment, I'm still enjoying the journey, still enjoying the ride, and, you know, hopefully I can continue, you know, playing a level of rugby that you know, deems me fit to be selected, you know, whether it be for Toulon or, you know, or the Springboks.
Yeah, take us back to that first game, Brian, because you debuted against England at Twickenham. You were 21 off the bench. You scored. What were you doing that half an hour before the game, man?
Yeah, so I'm not going to lie to you, that was probably one of the coldest days I've ever had to play rugby in my life. Obviously, we were coming up against an English side that had, you know, won the World Cup the year previously. So it all happened just so quickly. I'll never forget both wingers, Jean de Villiers and Ashton Williams, who got injured. And myself and a guy who I used to play a lot of schoolboy rugby with, Jacques Ferry, were on the bench as back replacements. And we both had to go on together. And I mean, it just all happened so quickly. And as I was about to run onto the field, our team manager called me back. And, you know, with only, I think there was 9.5 minutes left for the game, I was, you know, pretty disappointed that I'm not going to get on then. And as I get back to the bench, he said, no, you're still going on. You've just got to take the beanie that you got on your head off. I'm like, oh, crap. So it just goes by so quickly. And then I think to be able to score, you know, with my first touch of the ball in international rugby, against the then world champions at the home of rugby, I don't think I could have started the fairy tale any better. You know, so we went on to lose that game, which, you know, maybe would have made it better, but for me to have started out that way was really special to have got that opportunity and know that, well, now that you've arrived, you know, you need to stake your claim even further. So it was really special, you know, when people tell you beforehand that it goes by so quickly, I don't think you realize how quickly it goes by. I think it went even quicker given how cold it was for those 24 hours pre and post the game. So, no, it was really special. I think, you know, it was the starting block and the foundation for, you know, what has been an absolutely amazing career, you know, through the highs and the lows. And like I say, you know, through it all, I don't think I'd have it any other way.
Could you talk a little bit about how your mindset has shifted from that first score to when you became a father? Because if you look up for, you know, on your social medias, it's very evident, it's infectious, your smile and the affection for your little guy. Talk about how your mental game switched from when you're that young guy scoring to a young father and what it's meant to you having a son.
Yeah, John, I think the greatest thing, and I think that's probably the biggest debate for a lot of sports, and I think it's first of all finding someone that you can take the journey through with you. And I think I'm pretty fortunate to have someone amazing like, you know, like Janina as a partner who we sort of knew each other long before Brian O'Banner became, you know, Brian O'Banner, the rugby player. Yeah. So we were studying together at varsity, and, you know, we were good friends for 2-3 years before we actually started dating. And, you know, she thought I was actually going to go on and become a IT specialist after getting my degree. So wow. I probably fooled her a little bit like that. But then to go on and, you know, to become a father, I think that responsibility of not only the example you set, but I think the way you treat not only your kids but your partner and those around you is really important. I think, you know, having a child is probably, you know, one of the biggest blessings a person can, you know, can have, to be able to know that there's a part of you now living with you, and it's really special. And obviously there are the challenges of being a professional sportsman. I don't think the partners get as much credit as they do for husbands touring for 4 or 5 weeks at a time, you know, leaving them on their own to handle the situation. But again, to be able to wake up and know that this little boy, you know, just adores you for you, does understand that you're this world famous rugby player, does understand that there's media pressure, does understand that, you know, you got a 600,000 you know, social media following. You know, all he wants is your love and your attention. I think your mindset within that, you know, becomes one of, you know, making sure you lead by example, making sure that you show love. And again, I think in today's time and age where, you know, things like social media, you know, TV, there's just so many distractions, you know, that we have around us all the time, to be able to have that physical input and that physical attention is really important. So, you know, from that 21-year-old scoring at Twickenham back in 2004 to a dad having matching Mondays on, you know, on the creche run on a Monday morning, it has changed quite a bit. But, yeah, it's a journey that has been great. So it's one that I'm hoping. I think everyone tries to be the best at, but I think that example you set, you know, becomes really important.
Yeah, is there any one thing that you really want to push down, like something that maybe you learnt from your father?
Yeah, I think acceptance is probably the biggest thing. I think every person in this world is unique. Every person in this world has their own stories. And I think, you know, in this current world where we're living, I think people need inspiration. I think no matter where you're from, no matter what you do, I think, you know, being able to set a positive example is unbelievably important. And I think, you know, I was fortunate in terms of my folks not really showing me what apartheid was, or, you know, begrudging, you know, the system, and, you know, just leading a life where, you know, they love their kids. And I think for me to be able to set an example that you're not going to only learn from but flourish from, I think's really important. You know, I've been really blessed and privileged in my life, but I think, you know, you want to let your kids have a springboard. You know, you don't want to hold them back. So, yeah, I think just that example, you know, that I said is going to become pretty important, that he can know that, you know, whatever he sets his heart and dreams and passions to, you know, I'm going to be that springboard for him and not hold him back. So it's pretty challenging in the times we live in, but it's, you know, it's a great motivation for me to be the best at what I'm doing now, you know, and when rugby comes to an end, to make sure that I push even harder to make the transition to being, you know, as good as life after rugby as I was at it. So, yeah, a lot of challenges, but looking forward to that.
You mentioned earlier about, you know, being in IT, you know, if you wouldn't have got into rugby professionally, you'd have been an IT guy. Could you talk a little bit about and share some insights maybe to your fans that only know you as this high-level athlete, that things that you're into, maybe science, philosophy, astronomy, things like that?
Yeah, so I think I've always loved gadgets and technology. So, you know, when I went into that at varsity, I always thought that was going to be going to sort of be my forte. And I think if I put down some money on Apple shares, you know, back in 2001 when I started studying, I probably wouldn't be playing rugby at the moment. So I should have maybe asked my dad for a bit more money back then. But I think, first of all, being Christian, you know, there's just certain values and principles I like to live my life on. And again, you know, I'm sort of grateful to God that, you know, I've been given this talent to be able to do something I love each and every day of my life. I think to be able to inspire people and you know, be a beacon of light in a world that it just seems as there's not much of it at the moment, it's really, really important. And I think, you know, those are values that, you know, I hold dear, not only for myself but for my family. And I think the way in which we lead our life, I think not being able to hold grudges, not being able to judge, and, you know, making sure that, you know, you accept people for who they are and where they come from, because everyone has a very, very unique story. So and in today's day and age, I think it's sometimes very difficult. You know, people only show their best efforts, you know, especially celebrities or You know, people with a great following, they only show their best, you know, their best qualities on social media, whether it be Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, Facebook. And you know, I sometimes think, you know, there's a different layer to being real in terms of what you're sharing. So, you know, I have had a couple of dabs as opening up on Instagram and Twitter and stuff like that, which, again, you're not going to always please everyone. And I think as human beings, we always tend to look at the negative more than the positive. So, you know, when you have a Twitter following of about 400,000 and, you know, you're getting, you know, 10 or 15 or 20%, you know, bad comments or bad likes. It's unfortunately part of life. You're not going to please everyone. But I think, you know, for me, being able to be an example in terms of how I lead my life, both on and off the field, I think plays an integral part of, you know, the values I treasure and where, you know, where I want my life heading. So, yeah, not to say I don't believe in karma, but I think, you know, the, you know, what you put out there, you know, definitely comes back. So, you know, what you sow, you reap. And like I say, you know, hopefully I'm saying good things.
Yeah. Brian, just sticking on spirituality, when you score a try, which is a lot, you point to the sky, my man. Is there a meaning behind that?
Yeah, I guess for me, just to give thanks to God for being able to do something I love and being able to acknowledge that, you know, I'm the talent that I've been blessed with, I'm not taking for granted. I think I'm pretty fortunate that I get to do it, you know, more often than not. But I think it's just realizing, you know, for myself that, yeah, you're doing something amazing, but you know, you've been blessed with this ability to do it. So, you know, just make sure you acknowledge that. And I think, you know, with that comes a little bit of being humble in that knowing that, you know, first of all, I can't do this by myself. And that I believe that there's a greater strength out there, you know, helping me about. So, yeah, a little bit of that in that. And again, it's just about acknowledging where, you know, where it's coming from for me.
For all the talent that you do have and all the hard work you've put in to get you to where you are today, could you share with us maybe a moment in your career, maybe when you were younger, that you hit a standstill, maybe you started second-guessing your talent, maybe you had a conversation with your family about maybe quitting before you really got started? And if you did get to that moment, for our listeners at home who are struggling with like a moment of adversity, what sort of advice would you give them to keep going?
Yeah, Johnny, I think within every child's life, within every person's life, you know, I think there comes not only one, but I think there comes many points where you question your own ability, where you question, you know, not only if you've got the talent, but have you got the dedication? Have you got everything else that comes with wanting to achieve what you can achieve? And I think, you know, I was pretty fortunate that I think there were many times where I wanted to quit, and my dad just didn't say didn't do it, but he just kept on encouraging me. And I think that's the biggest thing, that, you know, even through those times of struggle, that there was a support system around me that, you know, made me believe in myself first and foremost, made me just get into touch reality that with hard work, you know, with persistence and perseverance, that anything could be achievable. And like I say, you become a Springbok and you become a professional athlete. And you know, there's many a time within your career where I think you doubt yourself, you doubt your ability. Where times are tough and the friends are very few. You know, you get booed off a stadium by 50,000 people, and I think if you don't second guess yourself, there might be something mentally wrong with you. So, you know, I've had some pretty nerve-ending moments where, again, you know, you get beaten 49-0 by Australia. You know, you get a record hiding against the All Blacks, or whatever. So I think for me, what's important is, you know, going back to the basics, understanding, you know, what you want to achieve as a person, having people around you, I think that support you, that back you, but that you can be real with as well, being able to give you proper sound advice. I think being in the professional sporting world, there's a lot of noise out there in terms of, you know, critics, in terms of people wanting to see you do badly. But I think it's about relying on a support system and a support structure that knows you, first of all, you know, knows your dedication, knows the ability you have to, you know, to achieve stuff. And then, you know, secondly, you know, making sure that you believe in yourself, you believe in that dream. And with that understanding that, you know, to achieve anything, you know, a lot of hard work, dedication and perseverance is going to be needed, because, yeah, I don't think there's many, you know, one day fly in the pan wonders that have, you know, come from nothing to get successful. So, yeah, it requires a lot of hard work and dedication, but having that structure behind you in terms of support, in terms of being able to be real with people, you know, has played a very important and critical role in getting me out of times of adversity.
Yeah. Brian, a lot of people talk about strengths. Like for yourself, you're very level-headed, you're fast on the field, you're strong, you're obviously very talented. What I want to talk to you about is your weaknesses. What weaknesses do you have, and what have you done to kind of rectify those?
Yeah, my current weakness is probably the amount of time I'm spending on my cell phone. I'm having my wife continually get me about that, right? But I think, yeah, I think there's, well, for me, I think in the beginning, I think, especially from a sporting point of view, I think I'd always known I'd had talent, but I probably wasn't always willing to work as hard, because it probably came easier than most when I had to do stuff. So, you know, so being quick, for instance, or having speed, you know, maybe not working on, you know, those elements, or being lazy because you know you had it, and you know, not trying to constantly improve on. I think, you know, being made aware of that stuff, like procrastinating and, you know, always, you know, putting stuff on the afterburner or until late was definitely one of my weak points, and probably still is. I think attention to details also not always my biggest forte, that I think, again, having people around you to shed some light on those elements, having people around you to, not only from a support point of view, but from a professional point of view, both on and off the field, you know, having people to talk to in terms of, you know, when you're struggling, or, you know, when you're struggling with one specific area in life, is really important, because sometimes you think you know it all, but I'm not Albert Einstein, and I don't think, you know, any of us were, and I think there was only one, so... and I don't even think Albert Einstein knew everything. So,
yeah.
You know, you can't know everything about everything. So being able to have those people around you that, you know, sort of understand and can help you in certain areas. And I think for yourself to acknowledge your weaknesses a lot of the times is really important. You know, my arm gets turned pretty quickly in terms of, you know, if someone says, let's go down to the beach, or let's avoid having work, you know, I'm pretty quick with that. And I think someone's just paying attention, saying, listen, we have to do this first before, you know, do work first before having the play is really important as well. So I think it's about understanding, you know, where you are in whatever situation you are in life, being able to acknowledge those weaknesses, and being able to step up and take responsibility is really important, because, like I say, if you don't take responsibility on the actions of overcoming those weaknesses, you're going to be left in the same place where you've always been.
What's up, guys? Be sure to pick up your free copy of Conversations with Champions. This is our free ebook, which is comprised of inspirational quotes from past guests that we've had on the show.
Get inspirational quotes from champions such as Evander Holyfield, Jonathan Thurston, Grant Cardone, Gary Vee, Larry Holmes, Mario Andretti, Anthony Mundine, Joe DeFranco, and many, many more.
To pick up your free copy now, just simply go to our website, www.divisionboardpodcast.com/ebook. Put your name and email in the slot. It takes about 10 seconds, and we'll send you the book directly to your inbox. Now back to the show.
You've referenced that one specific game against Australia, 49-0, and then we'll use that as a gauge, point A. And then you've also stood on the top of the mountain as the greatest, you know, one of the greatest players and team at that time as well. How would you define, if somebody asked, the difference between the successful and unsuccessful?
Oh, that's a pretty tough one, Johnny. I think the difference between, in terms of the time or in terms of,
I think,
or like the feelings.
I think in terms of the outcome, or you know how some of us, I think it's a human nature, human defense mechanism to kind of blame our certain circumstance on other things. Like, this didn't happen for me because, you know, it just didn't go my way. Do you feel like the people?
Yeah.
I was going
to
say,
I have to be really honest, I think if that 49-0 hadn't happened, and, you know, we'd gone over to Australia and New Zealand and, you know, had it easy, gone on and, you know, won the Tri Nations in 2006. Sitting here today, I probably believe we wouldn't have gone on to win the World Cup in 2007. So I think it was at that point of adversity where we found ourselves, you know, as a team, where we found ourselves in a particular place as an individual, in terms of struggle. You know, in the 2007 World Cup, we had a moment in the quarterfinal against Fiji down in Marseille, where the day before, France had just beaten New Zealand in Cardiff, and England, who we'd beaten 36-0 in the pool stages, you know, went on to beat Australia. And all of a sudden, you know, the two favourites of the tournament were out. And, you know, running out against Fiji, we were flying high. You know, we were at a point where we were 20 points all, and JP Peterson made a cross-cover tackle to one of their, I think it was their lock or their Lucy's, over the try line, where he knocked the ball on. And that was sort of a moment in the game where John Smith pulled us together, you know, made a few references to, you know, how far we'd come as a team, you know, from 49-0, from the struggles and everything. and was through that adversity that, you know, we became unbelievably strong. And at that moment in that World Cup, you know, we knew that it was now our destiny to go on and put a performance on for the last 20 minutes to show we were worthy of this World Cup. And we were able to draw strengths from the moments of adversity, the moments of struggle, and the moments where we were able to help define ourselves as individuals and as a team. So I believe that it's, you know, you learn a lot from adversity. And it was in those lows that, you know, we had to dig really deep for something that if we hadn't felt that, if we hadn't been in that circumstance, we wouldn't have been able to draw inspiration from that at a later stage. So, yeah, life, you know, if life is plain sailing, it's probably because you're flatlining on a hospital bed, you know, where, you know, you have to go through the challenges, you have to go through the ups, and it's, you know, when you're winning, it's great, but, you know, it's in those times of struggles, of really trying to, you know, find yourself, find, you know, the strength from deep inside that gives you that motivation to push a bit further. So, two very vastly different experiences in terms of feeling, in terms of the euphoria and the disappointment. But I think, you know, the one wouldn't be possible without the other.
Let's talk about you, though, in your own personal growth as a man and as an athlete, taken out of you being a team player. I'm sure you played with guys when you were younger who were maybe equally as talented, more, you know, just as skilled. Tristan and I are former athletes, and, you know, the list goes on about guys that, you know, at a certain age, you would think would make it to a certain level, but things happen and, you know, they kind of just dissipate and then end up stop playing. What do you think your point of difference was that allowed you to separate yourself from the pack when you were around like 17, 18, 19 to get you to where you are today? Was it a mental thing? Was it your circle of influence?
John, I think my circle of influence probably played a very big role you know, in making, you know, that breakthrough. I think for me also, for me personally, what helped a lot is a lot of the talented kids. So I, you know, because I started rugby later than most of kids in South Africa, you know, they start playing when they, you know, come out their mother's womb. I only started playing when I was about 14 years old. And just as a quick point of reference, I'd never played rugby before 1996. And, you know, when I went to high school at King Edwards, having not played it before, and all these primary schools coming together, they sort of needed to make a choice about how the kids are going to get ranked or rated in terms of placement. And we sort of had a race across the field, and they sort of tried to judge who was the quickest, slowest, and skill-wise. My first ever game of rugby was for the under-14 G side at King Edwards. And if you work out 8 to G, you know, one or two scrum-offs in a position, which I was still pretty small back then, it didn't quite start out how it planned. But then I got onto the field for that under-14 G side, and I just absolutely loved playing the game. And obviously, I, you know, I worked my way up, and I didn't make the South African schools. You know, I didn't make South African under-19s, where a lot of the talented guys around me had. And I think for me, it was just about that continuous support structure of, you know, having the people believing in me, of making the mental shift and decision that I'm going to continue working hard, that I'm never going to stop giving up on my dream. And the dream wasn't, you know, I think the dream was always to get one test, but it was to become a legend within the game. And I think for me, the difference was that a lot of guys, you know, maybe at a younger age had it a lot easier, where until I was 21, you know, I wasn't given any free passes. You know, life wasn't just about because you're talented, you're going to make it. I had to work unbelievably hard to get into teams and, you know, spend 4 years playing Vodacom Cup or, you know, a level of rugby, which a lot of talented youngsters at school never ever got to play because they went straight from, you know, the schooling system into a professional side. So, you know, I sort of had that amateur build-up, I think, which was really great, where I think I was able to find myself, I was able to find my areas of weakness, my, you know, areas of stuff that I needed to work on, but also find myself in terms of, you know, what works and what doesn't work. So I think for that, I'm pretty fortunate in terms that, you know, I wasn't just immediately thrown into the spotlight. But once I got into the spotlight, I'd had this, you know, 3-4 year period where, you know, I'd been working unbelievably hard to get to where I am. And that then formed the foundation for, you know, for the future.
Brian, let's talk about getting out of your comfort zone, because you moved from the security of home back in South Africa to a land that you've never been to in France. Can you just tell us a little bit about that move, man?
Yeah, so that was a pretty big one. I think there were actually two big ones. It was, first of all, moving from the Bulls in Pretoria down to Cape Town, which is like a north, you know, north-south rivalry, which goes back decades, where I'd had a very successful stint at the Bulls. So you know, once I'd moved on, I was seen as a traitor and everything. So, you know, I had to overcome that journey.
Yeah.
And then I got married and, you know, spent 4 amazing years in Cape Town, and, you know, we sort of brought our dream home. Janine started up her own business in Cape Town, and, you know, we thought life was settled. And then the opportunity came up again to come to Toulon. It's an opportunity that I had, you know, back in 2009 and in 2008. And I just decided that, you know, after 10 years of playing Super Rugby, I wanted something different. I wanted to challenge myself in a different way. And leading up into the 2015 World Cup, having had a rather iffy build up to the 2011 World Cup, I wanted to, you know, to grow myself in a different way. And obviously being in the Northern Hemisphere, playing in these conditions, and also having, you know, the World Cup in England in 2015, you know, sort of played a part in my decision to step out of my comfort zone. You know, obviously Toulon's an unbelievably beautiful city, but in terms of global metropole, you know, it's a very French village still. So English isn't that widely spoken outside of the club. You know, there's no support structure. So when we had a kid, there wasn't no grannies and granddads running around, you know, being able to help out. The support structure of knowing everything you had in South Africa was pretty challenging. You know, Janine actually went back to South Africa to have our little Timothy. So, yeah, it was very challenging. But again, reasons for doing it was to get out of my comfort zone. I think I fell in love with France back in 2007, so there was still a bit of that romantic side of having to come here. And experiencing something totally different was really important. So again, you know, just being able to push those boundaries to make sure that I almost breathe fresh life into my career. That again, not that you're starting from point zero, but that I also got an opportunity to play with other legends of the game, you know, guys like Johnny Wilkinson, Matt Gitta. So I've got to start playing with Bucky Spurta again, Ollie Williams, Carl Heyman, you know, the Armitage brothers, you know, Drew Mitchell, you know, this absolute legend of the game, which also inspired me in a different way. So yeah, it was a big decision. But looking back at now, you know, played an integral part in, you know, where I wanted to be in 2015 for the World Cup.
Yeah, did you find it hard at first? Because when you're playing in South Africa, everyone was South African. And then you come to Toulon, and like you said, you've got Australians, you've got South Africans, English, French. Was it hard with the culture change? Or?
Yeah, to be honest, not really. I think being able to play with the legends of the game, you know, made it really easy. You know, and that work ethic, that drive, you know, made it really professional in terms of, you know, on-field performances. And again, I played in the Barbarian side on a few occasions with the likes of Matt Gitta and Drew Mitchell. So I wouldn't say it's much different from that, but it's really easy. And obviously, it's legend of the game. I think when you take a rugby player from one team to another, it's still rugby. And then when you get to do it with some of the best players in the world, it's a pretty decent experience. You know, obviously, my first year was sort of plagued with quite a bit of injury, I think, which from my side was very frustrating. But, you know, in that first year I was here, we went on to win the double, the top 14 and the Champions Cup, or the Heineken Cup back then, which was really special. And again, one of the reasons I'd come over, to be a part of a successful team. So, yeah, you know, the guys within the squad were very welcoming, very understanding, and rugby players. So, you know, a lot of them Southern Hemisphere, which made it a little bit easier. And even the French guys were speaking English to me in the change room in that first year, so it made it a lot easier.
Brian, I'm not trying to compare the two sports, but for our Americans listening, the position you play in the sport you play at the highest level is equivalent to an American running back. So the NFL, there's an interesting stat about that position in the NFL. The average NFL running back, their lifeline's only 3 years in the league. So these guys, by the time they come out of college, are 22. A lot of them are done by the time they're 25 and 26. You being in your early 30s, you're still a young man. You're a young dude. But as the years start progressing a little more and more, are you thinking any transitioning maybe into coaching? Have you thought that far, or is it difficult for you to think outside of that spectrum because you're still playing?
Johnny, I think I've been, first of all, very fortunate to have been playing at the highest level out in the wing for such a long period of time. Obviously, you know, I'd love to have the same speed I had, you know, 8 years ago, but that unfortunately doesn't always happen. I'm not the slowest on the field at the moment, but you know, I might not be in the top one or two. So, yeah, I don't think, you know, my lifeline within the game of rugby is much longer. I've just signed a 1 year an extension with Toulon until June 2018. You know, I'll sort of see how the next year and a bit goes in terms of rugby wise. I think, you know, having played 15 years or 14 years at the highest level, you know, my body's really starting to feel it. 124 test matches later, 3 World Cups, and the 13 and a half full season of rugby hasn't been quite easy. And I think, again, there's pretty tough decisions I have to take, because you can sort of try hang on, you know, for that one step too far. In terms of, you know, getting back into the game, you know, once I'm done, I haven't really thought about it. I think the transition for any sportsman, I think we've been seeing it quite a bit publicized, you know, within global media over the last while. You know, that's transition from, you know, being a professional sportsman to getting into the real world, a really tough one. You know, a lot of people sort of get lost, you know, in that time frame, and, you know, then struggle for quite a while after that. So I think it is a challenge. I'd love to give back to the game in some way. You know, I've got one or two charity foundation stuff that I'm involved in terms of giving back. You know, in terms of consulting within rugby, and that's probably something I could look at. In terms of coaching, I'm not quite sure that's, you know, where I see myself. You know, from an administrative point of view, you know, also don't really want to get involved in terms of a lot of the off-field stuff. So, we'd like to give back, but also, you know, if possible, and again, you know, if I can plan well enough for whatever is left of my career, that you start making the step into the real world. Because I think, you know, yes, rugby's great, but it is just a short-term thing. You know, if I end in December next year, you know, I've hopefully still got my whole life ahead of me to do something. So, you know, I've got to start putting things in place now, not only to look after myself and my family, but to get that different drive and motivation going for the next phase of my life. So, yeah, I'd love to be involved, you know, maybe some commentary, maybe some you know, off-the-field work in terms of that. But, yeah, from a coaching point of view, I don't think, you know, I'm going to be hands-on. You know, might do a bit of consulting work, you know, globally. But, yeah, you know, we'd love to make the transition to life after rugby as smoothly and as quickly as possible.
Yeah. Brian, you talked about that aging process. I was just intrigued, your own training off the field, how much has that changed over the last couple of years?
Yes, it hasn't changed that much. I think what has changed is, you know, when I can get back into the training after a hard game on the weekend, you know, the body takes that little bit longer to recover. But I think obviously there's also been a massive increase in scientific knowledge and scientific awareness brought into professional sports globally, and all type of sports at the moment. So, you know, I'm actually currently working with a company called DNA Fit, which is a genetics-based organization within the UK that does DNA testing and, you know, has a pool of data samples to be able to measure, you know, what are the best training measurements and training examples for you. So I think it's about understanding your body and making sure that you know how you can push your body and where you can push your body. You know, obviously, I'm probably not running around as much as I was as a spring chicken 21-year-old, you know, 13 years ago. But it's being a little bit more wise, being a little bit more aware of your body. But yeah, you know, times have changed. And again, I think there's a lot better recovery now than there were back in the days. I think there's a lot better scientific knowledge in terms of, you know, how to recover, how to prepare your body properly. But again, I think for every stage of a career, that is all different. I think it's applying the best techniques to still be getting the best out of you, which is really important. You know, I think we're seeing a lot of stuff on social media of, you know, people getting millions of followers from eating properly or, you know, how they train. So I think it's about understanding your body. It's understanding, you know, from a professional point of view, that, you know, from your trainers and your sports and conditioning coaches, you know, that you align yourself best to get optimal performance on a Saturday. And, you know, whether that be an extra day of recovery, which I probably didn't get back when I was a youngster, you know, you got to look at it holistically and then each in unique case.
Okay, Brian, we've hit the personality round of the interview. Johnny's got the first question.
Yeah, so normally I would ask a standard question, but we've gotten into so many awesome topics and you've given great insight on really real life issues for our fans and yours alike. I have to ask you a question I didn't get a chance to. Did you really? All right, so when you raced the cheetah, it was well documented, you're in your prime, man, you're the fastest dude on the planet. How much of it was to spread awareness, and how much, be honest, did you think you could beat him?
To be honest, I'd probably say about 99% was literally to raise the awareness. And obviously, you know, you want to test yourself against the best, but, you know, I was never even like a full-on athlete. But, you know, what happened was, you know, my dad came to me with this program called the DeVolt Cheetah Tracker Program, and said, listen, these guys, you know, they got a few cheetahs that they've pulled in from the wild that, you know, come from various different scenarios, and, you know, they've been, you know, restored to proper health and care and whatever, and they come there, just want to, you know, highlight the plight of the cheetah becoming a scarce animal. I'm like, okay, cool. He's like, okay, you're going to race it. I'm like, okay, sounds cool, sounds exciting. So this was like sort of a 3-week planning process, and then we got to the actual, it's called a game reserve, or a reserve where these things were, and we sort of got to where this whole thing was happening. They built this stand, and there was like just this like very patchy 100-meter stretch of grass. And I'm like, this is not really, and I was actually playing rugby that week, and I'm like, oh, this is not really safe, not really effective. I was like, no, it'll be fine. Yeah, they planted the track 3 weeks ago. I'm like, 3 weeks ago, this grass was like still pretty, you know, not great. And I was like, okay, cool. And I was like, so where's the fence? And they go, no, we're not going to have a fence. I'm like, okay, that's all right. Okay. And then where's the guys that are going to be tracking, or the rangers? Because now we've got like one guy with a dart gun, dart like along the track. I'm like, just put my hands in the lap of one guy over 100 meters. I'm not quite sure how good this is. And I go, okay, well, what's going to stop the cheetah from, you know, just looking up from the lure, just at my behind and thinking that's a piece of rump and just grabbing a bite? So, yeah, a lot of it was for the, was for the plight and, you know, to raise awareness. But I think, again, there's been a lot of documented cases about, you know, people doing strange and obscene things. But I think, you know, that awareness that it created was really great. And I think the attention it got, especially after 2007, was really great. But, yeah, I'll probably be racing hippopotamuses now. If I have to.
Fair point.
All right, Brian Havana, when you were growing up, what posters did you have on your bedroom wall?
Before 1995, they were posters of a lot of the WWF superstars, the Hulk Hogan's, the Shawn Michaels of the world, the Undertakers of the world.
And we had Dallas Page on the show.
Post 1995, it would have been, you know, guys like US Fun Investors and Andre Joubert, James Small. You know, there might have been one or two Michael Jackson's, couple of FHM models when I was late teenager. But yeah, at the moment it's only family pictures. But yeah, those WWF superstars back in the late 80s, early 90s were a massive forte, and something I begged my dad on many an occasion to stay up quite late to watch the WrestleMania entrances.
Yeah, I was a Shawn Michaels. I was a Shawn Michaels guy.
Yeah, we had Diamond Dallas Page on the show late last year. And, DDP. We used to love that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I must say, I think all-time favorite though, I think the Wild Warrior.
Oh, yes.
I
used to love Sting, man. Crazy. I used to love Sting.
You mean the Ultimate Warrior?
Ultimate Warrior. Ultimate Warrior.
He was a beast.
Ultimate Warrior.
Rest in peace.
Yeah. He was, even in that stage, with guys like Hulk Hogan, the Ultimate Warrior was pretty impressive.
Yeah. Brian, if three of your closest friends were sitting in a room and you weren't in that room, what sort of things would they be saying about Brian Havana?
Depends who they are. What did they say? Behind my back, just hopefully good things. But they'd probably say I'm pretty loud, and that I take up most of the conversation. And if they had to, they'd probably beat me at a race at some point.
All right, to wrap things up, Brian, you're going to be hosting a private dinner party. The only rules, you've got 5 invites. You can choose anyone dead or alive. It just can't be any of your family or friends. Who are you inviting?
All right, so I think there needs to be some form of entertainment. So I'm gonna go Justin Timberlake, because after having seen his performance at the Oscars this year, he'd do a pretty good welcome entrance, and then he'd keep us pretty entertained for the whole evening. I definitely have Nelson Mandela there, just because of how much I admire him. I'd love to have Richard Branson there, just from an entrepreneurial point of view in terms of what he's been able to achieve. Where are we on to 3? So 2 more. That's pretty tough. I think in today's day and age, I'd probably like to have Barack Obama there as well. Just given what he had to overcome and how he had to do it. And then being a massive Apple fan and, you know, seeing how the guy made it grow from nothing in his garage, Steve Jobs would definitely have to be there as well. I think it would give him, you know, a lot of insight into, wow, what he was able to achieve, you know, creating the biggest company on, you know, on the planet. So, yeah, those would probably be my five.
Okay, everyone at home, you can find Brian online, brianhabana.com. On Facebook, he's at brianhabana11. Twitter, Brian Habana, and Instagram, Brian Habana _. Brian, my man, you've been awesome, man. We really appreciate sharing the space with you.
Brian, thank you for your time. Keep smiling. You're very inspiring to us and to all your fans. And keep doing what you're doing, man. We appreciate you.
Cool. Thanks, Johnny. Thanks, Tristan. And to all the guys on the Vision Board, keep on going strong.
Guys, that was Brian Habana.
Yeah, that was awesome, man. Sitting down, having him on a live video, seeing that smile, that energy, man. What an awesome dude.
Mate, I think you actually picked it before the whole thing. You said, what's going on with his smile? But yeah, he is an incredible human being, and I think that showed in the awesome hour that we got to spend with Brian.
Yeah, we love that. We love those, picking those point of differences with our guests. And all you have to do, if you don't know who Brian was before this interview, is Google him, and you see the photos and him out of his sport, and all you see is the guy smiling.
Yeah.
So it's almost like, you know, having experienced that with you, you could forget that this guy is at the highest level of his sport. You would just, you know what I mean? He doesn't, I think, sit in the mold of a jock.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. Guys, thanks for tuning in. Next on the show, Wednesday, we've got Yannick Silva. Yannick is an entrepreneur, author. He's actually friends with Richard Branson, and he's got, 120th to go to the space or something, John?
Right, he's on list to go to space. I'm really intrigued, and as you are as well, the Maverick 1000. We'll get into that later. You know, his exclusive group of entrepreneurs, his masterminds, and he's just another one, an example of continually stepping our game up by having guys like, you know, Brian and Yannick on the show.
Oh, I couldn't say it any better, man. It's that circle of influence that we talk about, and surrounding yourself with good people. So if there is any one thing that you take away from me and Johnny, it's really, you know, we've started this from scratch, and I think you can too. So reach out and meet good people and surround yourself with good people.
And guys, you listening at home is part of that circle of influence. You know what I mean? It's not just us. It's not just the guests. It's everybody. It's a collective agreement. It's a collective support system that we have here. And, man, it puts a smile on my face every day, and we can't thank you enough for supporting the cause.
Definitely. So, guys, we'll check you out on Wednesday. Any questions that you've got, please shoot them through at info@thevisionboardpodcast.com. But for now, we'll see you Wednesday.
Peace.
Welcome to the Vision Board Podcast, stories of success from around the world.
You guys are scratching an itch, and that's why this podcast has become popular and successful, is because you guys are scratching an itch. You're enjoying it, and you're also benefiting from the knowledge that people are dropping.
I've never met the person in my life, including my parents, that was able to outwill me about me.
Whatever profession you're in, you need to keep working harder. You know, nothing comes easy these days, and, you know, you'll get knocked down, but get back up, that counts, so just keep working hard at it.
You know, you guys said you do stuff, you ask things that aren't Googleable. You guys are two for two.
There's never been a time in my life where anybody ever was able to tell me who I was more than I knew who I was.
To join our vision and follow the journey, please subscribe to the Vision Board Podcast via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.